Russia launches new attacks on Ukraine over the weekend.
Kyiv said the airstrikes struck critical infrastructure in western Ukraine.
Why would ISIS-K attack a Russian music venue?
For past aggressions against what they have done, and the ISIS still sees the Russians doing and keeping Muslims down in the Middle East and different places in the Middle East.
Palestinians describe ongoing attacks near hospitals in Gaza.
The Israeli military says it has killed over 170 militants and detained 480 suspects.
And Senegalese voters cast ballots for their next president after delays. Today is Monday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Miller. An underground gas storage site in Ukraine was attacked on Sunday in the latest wave of Russian missile strikes on power facilities. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Sunday that more than 200,000 consumers in the country's second-largest city of Kharkiv were left without a stable electricity supply following what Kyiv said was Moscow's biggest attack of the war on Ukraine's power grid. Reuters' Trevor Carroll is up first with more.
Air raid sirens sounded in Kyiv after a wave of Russian missile strikes against Ukraine on Sunday. Residents made their way into subway stations to seek shelter. Kyiv said the airstrikes struck critical infrastructure in western Ukraine and that air defenses destroyed about a dozen missiles over the capital. One Russian cruise missile briefly flew about a mile into Polish airspace and stayed there for 39 seconds, according to Poland's defense minister. Russia has been pounding Ukraine for days in attacks portrayed by Moscow as revenge for Ukrainian attacks carried out during Russia's presidential election. Sunday's strikes come after Russia on Friday launched its largest aerial bombardment of Ukraine's energy system in more than 2 years of full-scale war. Ukraine's state energy firm Naftogaz said an underground gas storage site had been hit in the attacks on power facilities. On Sunday, Ukraine ramped up imports of electricity and halted exports. Naftogaz said delivery to customers had been unaffected.
Trevor Carroll reports for Reuters News. Also, the Ukrainian military said it hit two large Russian landing ships in attacks on the annexed Crimean Peninsula early on Sunday, as well as a communications center and other infrastructure used by the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. The statement didn't say how it hit the targets, but a Moscow-installed official in the region reported a major Ukrainian air attack and said that air defenses had shot down more than 10 missiles over the Crimean port of Sevastopol. However, VOA could not immediately verify the extent of the reported damage. Now, in Russia, the nation observed a day of mourning on Sunday following a deadly attack on a music venue in a Moscow suburb. The suspected attackers were taken to Basmani Court of Moscow, where they will be held in custody until trial. Islamic State has taken responsibility for the assault that killed at least 137 people, and VOA's Arash Arabasadi takes it from here.
Russian President Vladimir Putin lights a candle Sunday in memory of the victims of a mass killing at a music venue outside Moscow. Mourners lay flowers at a makeshift memorial at Crocus City Hall, the site of the deadliest attack in Russia in 20 years. Flags flew at half-staff at the Kremlin as Putin declared a day of mourning. It all started Friday at Crocus City Hall, a suburban Moscow music venue where gunmen stormed the building with automatic weapons and, according to Russian investigators, then used a flammable liquid to set the facility ablaze. Authorities say they've detained 11 people suspected in the attack, bringing them to the Russian Investigative Committee headquarters in Moscow. Little was left of Crocus City Hall by the time rescue workers began digging through debris. U.S. officials have said the Islamic State terror group's Afghan affiliate, known as Islamic State Khorasan, was behind the attack. But inside the Kremlin, officials began accusing Ukraine of involvement. Putin addressed the nation and, without evidence, said the attackers were moving towards Ukraine and that a passage was prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the border. It is a claim refuted by U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who spoke with ABC News as carried on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter.
No, there is no whatsoever any evidence. And in fact, what we know to be the case is that ISIS-K is actually, by all accounts, responsible for what happened.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said, quote, Putin and other scumbags are just trying to find someone else to blame, adding that Russian forces invading his country could have stopped such a deadly attack if not preoccupied by war. Russian investigators say they found weapons and other evidence linked to the attackers as they begin the process of piecing together the night's events. And while much of the recent news outside Russian embassies and consulates focused on the still mysterious death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, at the embassy in Serbia, people laid flowers, lit candles, and signed a book of condolences. The United Arab Emirates illuminated iconic buildings with the Russian flag in solidarity with the night's growing list of victims. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
So, what are the biggest takeaways from the concert hall attack in Moscow? For analysis, I'm joined by Craig Albert, political science professor and graduate director of the Master in Arts and Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. Craig, where I want to begin is, I guess, as you watch the events unfold with this attack on this concert hall in Moscow, what were your biggest takeaways since the U.S. Embassy had warned at the early onset of March that there were some warning signs that an attack like this was imminent?
The first thing that came to mind is, why didn't President Putin take the warnings from the United States and other NATO allies very seriously, or seriously at all? In fact, he, you know, right out dismissed the warnings and said it was U.S. attempts to try to influence the elections by saying that there were going to be attacks. So he just completely dismissed them out of hand. And that's one thing to do, to say that publicly. But as we see from the attacks, he didn't bolster the national police forces either. So, like, one would have expected him to, like, say something like that so he can, like, save face in Russia and not look like he's taking advice from the United States, but still increase his police presence and guards around concert halls, which were specifically, by the way, called out in the intel reports that the United States sent President Putin. So the U.S. had very direct intelligence about what was going to be targeted, maybe not specifically the building, but they knew it was going to be a concert hall as one of the possibilities. So it's just astonishing for somebody who has such a stronghold over his people, that that's the biggest takeaway, is that, wow, like, something's slipping with President Putin to ignore everything and let that occur.
The Islamic State group claimed responsibility, but the United States feels that Islamic State Khorasan is the group that is responsible for this attack. ISIS-K, Islamic State Khorasan, has roots in the Middle East. So, you know, what's their potential motive to carry out an attack like this in the heart of Russia?
This is a great question. It would be because ISIS-K would target Russia for what they have done in Syria, for past aggressions against what they have done, and the ISIS still sees the Russians doing and keeping Muslims down in the Middle East and different places in the Middle East, how the Russians have treated the Caucasus for the past few decades. In fact, in one note that I've saw from ISIS-K, they specifically mention targeting Russia because of Russia's past atrocities in Chechnya specifically and in Syria recently. And that's why, for me, I thought for sure this would be an ISIS attack from the Caucasus Emirates. And that's what I'm still wondering about, is if the Caucasus Emirates somehow teamed up with ISIS-K. Again, there's no evidence of this or anything. There's not much evidence that's been released on exactly what group it is. But to answer your question, that's what it would be, would the historical aggressions of Russia against Syria specifically and against Chechnya itself, that ISIS-K, which is trying to become the leader now of ISIS, trying to become ISIS home base now in the past couple of years since ISIS in Iraq has significantly dwindled. So that would be their main motivation, is trying to say that the caliphate is going to happen from Afghanistan now, and they're going to attack any Christian civilization that has waged war against Muslims recently.
Craig Albert is a political science professor, as well as the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. Craig, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
We're also following these other stories. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is facing a day of financial reckoning on Monday. Trump, the likely Republican presidential nominee in November's general election, is facing a deadline to put up $454 million in cash or a bond backed by collateral from his assets. If he can't come up with the cash or a bond, New York State Attorney General Letitia James appears poised to start a lengthy process of seizing some of Trump's prominent office skyscrapers in New York City. Officials in Nigeria say 137 school children have been rescued more than 2 weeks after they were seized in the northwestern state of Kaduna and marched into the forest. School authorities had told the state government that a total of 287 students were kidnapped during the school attack on March 7th. Abductions of students from schools in northern Nigeria are common and have become a source of concern since 2014 when Islamic extremists kidnapped over 200 schoolgirls in Borno State's Chibok village. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says Israeli forces besieged two more Gaza hospitals on Sunday, pinning down medical teams under heavy gunfire. Karen Chamas from the Associated Press continues our coverage.
Those who have fled the area described days of heavy fighting, mass arrests, and forced marches. One man who lived with his parents and brothers just yards from Al-Shifa Hospital described the scene. He said he and his family were huddled together in the kitchen for days while gunfire and explosions echoed outside. Israeli troops then stormed his building and forced them and dozens of other residents to leave. He says the men were forced to strip to their underwear and four were detained. The rest were blindfolded and ordered to follow a tank south as more blasts thundered around them. The following morning, a plume of smoke could be seen rising in Gaza City near the hospital as the sound of aid airplanes could be heard approaching the area. The Israeli military says it has killed over 170 militants and detained 480 suspects in the raid on Shifa Hospital. I'm Karen Chamas.
Also, Palestinian health officials say that an Israeli airstrike hit the city of Rafah during the early morning hours on Sunday, killing seven and wounding several others. Israel claims Rafah is the last bastion for Hamas militants and that it has a plan to evacuate civilians before an attack, though it has not shared one publicly nor with close ally Washington. This comes as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that Palestinians in Gaza desperately need a flood of aid, not trickles.
Some progress has been made, but much more needs to be done.
Guterres made the statement after meeting with Egypt's president and foreign minister in the new administrative capital. He's visiting Egypt and Jordan as part of an annual Ramadan solidarity tour to Muslim countries and traveled on Saturday to Egypt's border with Gaza, where he called the backlog of aid destined for the Palestinian territory a moral outrage. We'll have additional coverage of the Israel-Hamas war, as well as a possible vote on a ceasefire measure at the UN Security Council, and updates from Russia and Ukraine on our website, as well as on our Monday episode of Flashpoint Global Crises. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Election workers started tallying ballots Sunday evening in Senegal in an election that would determine the country's fifth president. It comes after a turbulent campaign season that saw the election delayed and politicians released from prison. At stake is the potential end of a regime that has pushed investor-friendly policies but failed to alleviate economic hardship in one of coup-prone West Africa's more stable democracies, just as it's poised to become an oil and gas producer. Multiple candidates congratulated anti-establishment figure Bassirou Diomaye Faye on his first-round win, but official tallies have not been released. VOA's Mariama Diallo continues our coverage.
It's a day many have been waiting for, including Jules Roland Pascal Diatta. He was the first to cast his ballot in voting room number 7 at a school about 30 minutes outside Dakar's city center. He arrived 2.5 hours before the poll officially opened.
Je vois que vraiment...
He says, I see that they are actually on time and open at 8 a.m. sharp. This is a very important election for me and everyone here. I like my candidate because he has a solid and well-defined program that I think could save Senegal. He says he voted for the coalition led by Bassirou Diomaye Faye. Faye, a former tax inspector, is backed by Ousmane Sonko, who was seen as the key challenger to outgoing President Macky Sall. Sonko was barred from running in this year's elections over a previous defamation conviction. Both Faye and Sonko were recently released from prison. Another voter, Ahmadou Hadim Lowe, hopes for job creation to be the number one goal for the next leader. He says 75% of the Senegalese population is young, and many of them have diplomas but can't find jobs, a sentiment echoed by Khadijane, who spoke to us before casting her vote.
Senegal, the today.
She says living conditions are difficult here. The healthcare system is poor. There are no jobs. I could spend an entire year telling you about all the problems our country has. About 17 candidates are vying for the top job, including former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who's endorsed by Sall. Seynabou Faye told us she wants a continuation of the policies of the current regime. Telling us, I just love Macky Sall. He's done more work than any other president before him. He's built bridges, the bus rapid transit system, stadiums, roads. I would like to see Amadou Ba win so he can work on some of Sall's unfinished projects. Ndoumbé Gueye is the head of voting room number 7 at the polling station in the neighborhood of Scott Urbam. She explained the voting process. She said, once a voter comes in, he or she shows me the national identification card first. My team verifies that the person is registered and this is the right place for them to vote. Then they can pick 5 out of the 19 candidates, pick up an envelope, and proceed to the voting booth. Their final choice can be inserted into the envelope and submitted. Once that's done, they come back to us and dip their small finger in ink to show they've voted. Observers from many organizations are also present, including some from the European Union, which sent 100 observers all over the country. Malene Bjork, who heads the group which arrived in early January, held a news conference Sunday morning. She notes, what we've been able to observe is that the polling started on time with sometimes long lines, which shows that people are motivated and interested in voting. The material was in place and the rules were followed by all voting centers. Senegal has always been seen as a stable democracy in a region plagued by coups, until recently when President Sall tried unsuccessfully to postpone last month's elections by 10 months. While Sall said he would not seek a third term, his critics accused him of wanting to hold on to power. Whoever wins today's elections are a chance to maybe put those uncertainties to rest. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And finally, the fountain pen is a writing instrument declared obsolete numerous times by technological innovation, by the ballpoint pen, the typewriter, then the computer keyboard, and now by rendering our voices into text on cell phones. But the 19th century invention is still in demand and is itself evolving, thanks to a young American mechanical engineer. Steve Herman has that story to round us out.
In a warehouse in a gritty Philadelphia neighborhood, Ian Sean is doing something no one else in America does: manufacturing writing implements with nibs, the business end of the pen, handcrafted from titanium.
The way we're doing it is really what makes us separate from the other brands and other companies that have done this in the past, which is utilizing equipment in this workshop that's traditionally designed for aerospace or medical manufacturing and repurposing it to create an innovative, unique experience that is just different.
Not only different in the 21st century, it's also counterintuitive. With a risky investment and expensive equipment to make a product for a niche market.
a fountain pen's impractical. It can be messy. It's not as good as a ballpoint pen. It's expensive. So it's really in line with the culture of the pen user that it's irrational and strange.
Showing off his collection at Philadelphia's 130-year-old Pen and Pencil Club, formed by journalists fielding fountain pens to conduct their interviews, investment analyst Tony Blair says the antiquated writing instrument endures as an antidote to the digital age.
Anytime you introduce input-output, like you do with a computer, now there's also, well, there's these other distractions, and if I get a pop-up and lose my thread, am I going to remember it to the same way that I think writing something by hand helps you remember it?
For many of the younger generations who did not get instruction in cursive script, this instrument is as mysterious as the rotary-dialed telephone or the film camera.
Now we have a really cool collection that I would say is great for novice users in particular.
That's Liz Sieber, owner of Philadelphia's Omoizaka Japanese-themed stationery shop, which sells fountain pens, writing paper, and ink.
Some people really understand what the different nibs are about and the difference between a machine-aligned or a hand-aligned nib. And then we also meet a lot of people who have never tried one before.
More stores in Japan than in the United States carry Sean's made-in-Philadelphia pens, thus creating a tiny entry on the export side of America's trade deficit ledger.
I love that challenge. I love being the underdog.
That challenge is also writing a new page in the story of American entrepreneurship. Steve Herman, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for joining us. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 24th is World Tuberculosis Day. The observance is an opportunity to draw attention to one of the world's oldest and deadliest diseases. This year's theme is Yes, We Can End TB. It is the same theme as last year's, to emphasize a message of hope to those who continue to suffer with the disease. The date commemorates Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacterium that causes the disease. Dr. Koch's breakthrough opened the way towards diagnosing and curing TB, the first steps in a decades-long journey which culminated in the discovery and eventual mass production of antibiotics. Tuberculosis, or TB, has plagued humans for thousands of years. The bacterium that causes it is believed to have evolved along with people, and it is still evolving. The good news is that since the year 2000, 75 million lives have been saved, thanks to global efforts to end tuberculosis. The bad news is that as recently as 2022, 10.6 million people fell ill with the disease and 1.3 million died of it. Most TB deaths occur in the developing world, where the disease is closely linked to poverty. For one, impoverished people are more likely to live in overcrowded conditions with poor ventilation and lack proper hygiene and nutrition. These are the perfect conditions for the spread of this contagious illness. Second, the poor often lack access to diagnosis and care, or effective treatment may not be accessible or dependable. At the time of Dr. Koch's discovery of the tuberculosis bacterium, TB was one of the world's most feared diseases, reaching epidemic levels in Europe and the Americas, and causing one out of every seven deaths. Today, it is still the world's deadliest infectious disease. With treatment, the recovery rate stands at about 85%. Without treatment, TB kills half of its victims. The United States is a leader in the fight against TB. In 2023, USAID launched the Global Accelerator to End TB Plus initiative. One of the program's ambitious goals is to reach and deliver prevention and care services to 90% of people with TB. If countries that pledged funding for the programs follow through on their commitments, we may see the end of this killer disease by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.